One by one, the Dolby-eyed voices in the next room signed off until only Dr. X and another gentleman were left, haggling about something desultorily, taking long breaks between volleys of tweeter-busting oratory to stoke pipes, pour tea, or whatever these people did when they were pretending to ignore each other. The discussion petered out rather than building to a violent climax, as Hackworth had secretly, mischievously been hoping, and then a young fellow pulled the curtain aside and said, "Dr. X will see you now." Dr. X was in a lovely, generous mood, probably calculated to convey the impression that he'd always known Hackworth would be back. He rustled to his feet, shook Hackworth's hand warmly, and invited him out to dinner, at a place nearby, he said portentously, of utmost discretion. It was discreet because one of its cozy private dining rooms was connected directly to one of the back rooms of Dr. X's establishment, so that one could reach it by walking down a sinus-inflated nanobar tube that would have stretched a half a kilometer long if you extricated it from Shanghai, took it to Kansas, and pulled on both ends. Squinting through the translucent walls of the tube as he assisted Dr. X to dinner, Hackworth cloudily glimpsed several dozen people pursuing a range of activities in some half-dozen different buildings, through which Dr. X had apparently procured some kind of right-of-way. Finally, it spat them out into a nicely furnished and carpeted dining room, which had been retrofitted with a powered sliding door. The door opened just as they were sitting down, and Hackworth was almost knocked off balance as the tube sneezed nano-filtered wind. A beaming 4-foot-tall waitress stood in the doorway, closing her eyes and leaning forward against the anticipated wind blast. In perfect San Fernando Valley English, she said,
"Would you like to hear about our specials?"
Dr. X was at pains to reassure Hackworth that he understood and sympathized with his situation. So much so that Hackworth spent much of the time wondering whether Dr. X had already known about it. "Say no more. It is taken care of," Dr. X finally said, cutting Hackworth off in mid-explanation. And after that, Hackworth was unable to interest Dr. X in the topic any more. This was reassuring but unsettling, as he could not avoid the impression that he had just somehow agreed to a deal whose terms had not been negotiated or even thought about. But Dr. X's whole effect seemed to deliver the message that if you were going to sign a Faustian bargain with an ancient and inscrutable Shanghainese organized crime figure, you could hardly do better than the avuncular Dr. X, who was so generous that he would probably forget about it altogether, or perhaps just stow the favor away in a yellowed box in one of his warrens. By the end of the lengthy meal, Hackworth was so reassured that he had almost forgotten about Lieutenant Chang and the primer altogether. Until, that is, the door slid open again to reveal Lieutenant Chang himself. Hackworth hardly recognized him at first, because he was dressed in a much more traditional outfit than usual. Baggy indigo pajamas, sandals, and a black leather skull cap that concealed about 75% of his knot-like skull. Also, he'd begun to grow his whiskers out. Most alarmingly, he had a scabbard affixed to his belt, and the scabbard had a sword in it. He stepped into the room and bowed perfunctorily to Dr. X, then turned to face Hackworth.
"Lieutenant Chang?" Hackworth said weakly.
"Constable Chang," said the interloper, "of the District Tribunal of Shanghai." And then he said the Chinese words that meant Middle Kingdom.
"I thought you were Coastal Republic."
"I have followed my master to a new country," Constable Chang said. "I must regretfully place you under arrest now, John Percival Hackworth."
"On what charge?"
Hackworth said, forcing himself to chuckle as if this were all a big practical joke among close friends. "That you did bring stolen intellectual property into the Celestial Kingdom, specifically into the Hong of Dr. X, and did use that property to compile an illegal copy of a certain device known as the Young Lady's Illustrated Primer." There was no point in claiming that this was not true.
"But I have come here this evening specifically to regain possession of that same device," Hackworth said, "which is in the hands of my distinguished host here. Certainly you're not intending to arrest the distinguished Dr. X for trafficking in stolen property."
Constable Chang looked expectantly toward Dr. X. The doctor adjusted his robes and adopted a radiant, grandfatherly smile.
"I am sorry to tell you that some reprehensible person has apparently provided you with wrong information," he said. "In fact, I have no idea where the primer is located."
The dimensions of this trap were so vast that Hackworth's mind was still reeling through it, bouncing haplessly from one wall to another, when he was hauled before the district magistrate 20 minutes later. They had set up a courtroom in a large, ancient garden in the interior of old Shanghai. It was an open square paved with flat gray stones. At one end was a raised building open to the square on one side, covered with a sweeping tile roof whose corners curved high into the air and whose ridgeline was adorned with a clay frieze portraying a couple of dragons facing off with a large pearl between them. Hackworth realized dimly that this was actually the stage of an open-air theater, which enhanced the impression that he was the sole spectator at an elaborate play written and staged for his benefit. A judge sat before a low, brocade-covered table in the center of the stage, dressed in magnificent robes and an imposing winged hat decorated with a unicorn emblem. Behind him and off to one side stood a small woman wearing what Hackworth assumed were phenomenoscopic spectacles. When Constable Chang had pointed to a spot on the gray flagstones where Hackworth was expected to kneel, he ascended to the stage and took up a position flanking the judge on the other side. A few other functionaries were arranged on the square, mostly consisting of Dr. X and members of his retinue, arranged in two parallel lines, forming a tunnel between Hackworth and the judge. Hackworth's initial surge of terror had worn off. He had now entered into morbid fascination with the incredible dreadfulness of his situation and the magnificent performance staged by Dr. X to celebrate it. He knelt silently and waited in a stunned, hyper-relaxed state, like a pithed frog on a dissection table. Formalities were gone through, the judge was named Fang, and evidently came from New York. The charge was repeated, somewhat more elaborately. The woman stepped forward and introduced evidence. A cine record that was played on a large mediatron covering the back wall of the stage. It was a film of the suspect, John Percival Hackworth, slicing a bit of skin from his hand and giving it to the innocent Dr. X, who, not knowing that he was being gulled into committing a theft, extracted a terabyte of hot data from a cocklebur-shaped mite, and so on, and so on. The only thing that remains is to prove that this information was indeed stolen, though this is strongly implied by the suspect's behavior, Judge Fang said. In support of this assertion, Constable Chang stepped forward and told the story of his visit to Hackworth's flat. Mr. Hackworth, said Judge Fang, would you like to dispute that this property was stolen? If so, we will hold you here while a copy of the information is supplied to Her Majesty's police. They can confer with your employer to determine whether you did anything dishonest. Would you like us to do that?
No, Your Honor, Hackworth said.
So you are not disputing that the property was stolen and that you deceived the subject of the Celestial Kingdom into colluding with your criminal behavior?
I am guilty as charged, Your Honor, Hackworth said, and I throw myself on the mercy of the court.
Very well, Judge Fang said. The defendant is guilty. The sentence is 16 strokes of the cane and 10 years imprisonment.
Goodness gracious, Hackworth murmured.
Inadequate as this was, it was the only thing that came to him. Insofar as the strokes of the cane are concerned, since the defendant was motivated by his filial responsibility to his daughter, I will suspend all but one on one condition.
Your Honor, I shall endeavor to comply with whatever condition you may choose to impose.
That you supply Dr. X with the decryption key to the data in question, so that additional copies of the book may be made available to the small children crowding our orphanages.
This I will gladly do, Hackworth said. But there are complications.
I'm waiting, Judge Fang said, not sounding very pleased. Hackworth got the impression that this business about the caning and the primer was a mere prelude to something bigger, and that the judge just wanted to get through it.
In order for me to weigh the seriousness of these complications, Hackworth said, I will need to know how many copies approximately Your Honor intends to make.
In the range of hundreds of thousands.
Hundreds of thousands? Please excuse me, but does Your Honor understand that the book is engineered for girls starting around the age of 4?
Yes. Hackworth was taken aback. Hundreds of thousands of children of both sexes and all ages would not have been difficult to believe. Hundreds of thousands of 4-year-old girls was hard for the mind to grasp. Just one of them was quite a handful. But it was, after all, China.
The magistrate is waiting, Constable Chang said. I must make it clear to Your Honor that the primer is, in large part, a ractive. That is, it requires the participation of adult ractors. While one or two extra copies might go unnoticed,
A large number of them would overwhelm the built-in system provided for paying for such services. Then part of your responsibility will be to make alterations in the premise so that it is suitable for our requirements. We can make do without those parts of the book that depend heavily on outside Ractus, and supply our own Ractus in some cases, Judge Fang said. This should be feasible. I can build in automatic voice generation capabilities, not as good, but serviceable.
At this point, John Percival Hackworth, almost without thinking about it and without appreciating the ramifications of what he was doing, devised a trick and slipped it in under the radar of the judge and Dr. X and all of the other people in the theater, who were better at noticing tricks than most other people in the world.
While I'm at it, if it pleases the court, I can also, Hackworth said most obsequiously, make changes in the content so that it will be more suitable for the unique cultural requirements of the Han readership. But it will take some time.
Very well, said Judge Fang. All but one stroke of the cane is suspended, pending the completion of these alterations. As for the 10 years of imprisonment, I am embarrassed to relate that this district, being very small, does not have a prison, and so the suspect will have to be released this evening after the business with the cane is finished. But rest assured, Mr. Hackworth, that your sentence will be served, one way or another.
The revelation that he would be released to his family this very evening hit Hackworth like a deep lungful of opium smoke. The caning went by quickly and efficiently. He did not have time to worry about it, which helped a little. The pain sent him straight into shock. Chang pulled his flaccid body off the rack and bore him over to a hard cot, where he lay semi-conscious for a few minutes. They brought him tea, a nice key moon with distinct lavender notes. Without further ado, he was escorted straight out of the Middle Kingdom and into the streets of the Coastal Republic, which had never been more than a stone's throw away from him during all these proceedings, but which might as well have been 1,000 miles and 1,000 years distant. He made his way straight to a public matter compiler, moving in a broad-based gait with tiny steps, bent over somewhat, and compiled some first aid supplies, painkillers and some hemocules that supposedly helped to knit wounds together. Thoughts about the second part of the sentence, and how he might end up serving it, did not come back to him until he was halfway back across the causeway, borne swiftly on autoskates, the wind keening through the fabric of his trousers and inflaming the laceration placed neatly across his buttocks, like the track of a router. This time he was surrounded by a flock of hornet-sized aerostats, flying in an ellipsoidal formation all around him, hissing gently and invisibly through the night and waiting for an excuse to swarm. This defensive system, which had seemed formidable to him when he compiled it, now seemed like a pathetic gesture. It might stop a youth gang, but he had insensibly transcended the plane of petty delinquents and moved into a new realm, ruled by powers almost entirely hidden from his ken, and knowable to the likes of John Percival Hackworth only insofar as they perturbed the trajectories of the insignificant persons and powers who happened to be in his vicinity. He could do naught but continue falling through the orbit that had been ordained for him. This knowledge relaxed him more than anything he had learned in many years, and when he returned home, he kissed the sleeping Fiona, treated his wounds with more therapeutic technology from the MC, covered them with pajamas, and slid beneath the covers. Drawn inward by Gwendolyn's dark, radiant warmth, he fell asleep before he had even had time to pray.
More Tales from the Primer. The Story of Dinosaur and Dojo. Nell learns a thing or two about the art of self-defense. Nell's mother gets and loses a worthy suitor. Nell asserts her position against a young bully. She loved all of her four companions, but her favorite had come to be Dinosaur. At first she'd found him a little scary, but then she'd come to understand that though he could be a terrible warrior, he was on her side and he loved her. She loved to ask him for stories about the old days before the extinction and about the time he had spent studying with the Mouse Dojo.
There were other students, too, said the book,
speaking in Dinosaur's voice, as Nell sat by herself in the corner of the playroom.
In those days, we had no humans, but we did have monkeys. And one day, a little girl monkey came to the entrance of our cave, looking quite lonely. Dojo welcomed her inside, which surprised me, because I thought Dojo only liked warriors. When the little monkey saw me, she froze in terror. But then Dojo flipped me over his shoulder and bounced me off the walls of the cave a few times to demonstrate that I was fully under control.
He made her a bowl of soup and asked her why she was wandering around the forest all by herself. The monkey, whose name was Belle, explained that her mother and her mother's boyfriend had kicked her out of the family tree and told her to go swing on the vines for a couple of hours. But the bigger monkeys hogged all the vines and wouldn't let Belle swing. So Belle wandered off into the forest, looking for companionship, and got lost, finally stumbling upon the entrance to Dojo's cave.
"You may stay with us for as long as you like," Dojo said. "All we do here is play games, and you are invited to join our games if it pleases you." "But I am supposed to be home soon," Belle complained. "My mother's boyfriend will give me a whipping otherwise."
"Then I will show you the way from your family tree to my cave and back," Dojo said, "so that you can come here and play with us whenever your mother sends you out." Dojo and I helped Belle find her way back through the forest to her family tree. On our way back to the cave, I said, "Master, I do not understand."
"What seems to be the trouble?" Dojo said.
"You are a great warrior, and I am studying to become a great warrior myself. Is there a place in your cave for a little girl who just wants to play?"
"I'll be the judge of who does and who doesn't make a warrior," Dojo said.
"But we are so busy with our drills and exercises," I said. "Do we have time to play games with the child, as you promised?"
"What is a game but a drill that's dressed up in colorful clothing?" Dojo said.
"Besides, given that, even without my instruction, you weigh 10 tons and have a cavernous mouth filled with teeth like butcher knives, and that all creatures except me flee in abject terror at the mere sound of your footsteps, I do not think that you should begrudge a lonely little girl some playtime." At this I felt deeply ashamed, and when we got home, I swept out the cave 7 times without even being asked. A couple of days later, when Belle came back to our cave looking lonely and forlorn, we both did our best to make her feel welcome. Dojo began playing some special games with her, which Belle enjoyed so much that she kept coming back, and believe it or not, after a couple of years of this had gone by, Belle was able to flip me over her shoulder just as well as Dojo. Nell laughed to think of a little girl monkey flipping a great dinosaur over her shoulder. She went back one page and reread the last part more carefully. A couple of days later, when Belle came back to our cave looking lonely and forlorn, we both did our best to make her feel welcome. Dojo made a special meal in his kitchen out of rice, fish, and vegetables, and made sure that she ate every scrap. Then he began playing a special game with her called Somersaults. An illustration materialized on the facing page. Nell recognized the open space in front of the entrance to Dojo's cave. Dojo was sitting up on a high rock, giving instructions to Dinosaur and Belle. Dinosaur tried to do a somersault, but his tiny front arms could not support the weight of his massive head, and he fell flat on his face. Then Belle gave it a try and did a perfect somersault. Nell tried it too. It was confusing at first, because the world kept spinning around her while she did it. She looked at the illustration in the book and saw Belle doing exactly what Nell had done, making all of the same mistakes. Dojo scampered down from his rock and explained how Belle could keep her head and body straight. Nell followed the advice as she gave it another try, and this time it felt better. Before her time was up, she was doing perfect somersaults all over the playground. When she went back to the apartment, Mom wouldn't let her in at first, so she did somersaults up and down the hall for a while. Finally, Mom let her in, and when she saw that Nell had gotten sand in her hair and shoes down at the playground, she gave her a spanking and sent her to bed without any food. But the next morning she went to the MC and asked it for the special meal Dojo made for Belle. The MC said it couldn't really make fish, but it could make nano surimi, which was kind of like fish. It could make rice, too. Vegetables were a problem. Instead, it gave her some green paste she could eat with a spoon. Nell told the MC that this was her Belle food and that she was going to have it all the time from now on. And after that, the MC always knew what she wanted. Nell didn't call it her magic book anymore. She called it by the name printed plain as day on the title page, which she'd only been able to read recently. Young Lady's Illustrated Primer, a propaedeutic enchiridion, in which is told the tale of Princess Nell and her various friends, kin, associates, etc. The primer didn't speak to her as often as it used to. She had found that she could often read the words more quickly than the book spoke them, and so she usually ordered it to be silent.
She often put it under her pillow and had it read her bedtime stories, though, and sometimes she even woke up in the middle of the night and heard it whispering things to her that she had just been dreaming about. Tad had long since vanished from their home, though not before giving Mom a broken nose. He'd been replaced by Shemp, who'd been replaced by Todd, who had given way to Tony. One day, the Shanghai police had come to arrest Tony, and he had plugged one of them right in the living room with his skull gun, blowing a hole in the guy's stomach so that intestines fell out and trailed down between his legs. The other policemen nailed Tony with a 7-minute special and then dragged their wounded comrade out into the hallway while Tony, bellowing like a cornered rabid animal, ran into the kitchen and grabbed a knife and began hacking at his chest where he thought the 7-minute special had gone into his body. By the time the 7 minutes had gone by and the policeman burst back into the apartment, he had dug a hole in his pectoral muscle all the way down to his ribs. He'd menaced the cops with his bloody knife, and the cop in charge punched in some numbers on a little black box in his hand, and Tony buckled and screamed as a single cookie cutter detonated inside his thigh. He dropped the knife. The cops rushed in and shrink-wrapped him, then stood around his body, mummified in glistening plastic, and kicked him and stomped him for a minute or two, then finally cut a hole in the plastic so Tony could breathe. They bonded 4 handles onto the shrink-wrap and then carried him out between them, leaving Nell to clean up the blood in the kitchen and the living room. She wasn't very good at cleaning things up yet, and ended up smearing it around. When Mom got home, she screamed and cried for a while, and then spanked Nell for making a mess. This made Nell sad, and so she went to her room and picked up the primer and made up a story of her own about how the wicked stepmother had made Princess Nell clean up the house and had spanked her for doing it wrong. The primer made up pictures as she went along. By the time she was finished, she had forgotten about the real things that had happened and remembered only the story she had made up. After that, Mom swore off men for a while, but after a couple of months she met a guy named Brad who was actually nice. He had a real job as a blacksmith in the New Atlantis Clave, and one day he took Nell to work with him and showed her how he nailed iron shoes onto the hooves of the horses. This was the first time Nell had actually seen a horse, and so she did not pay much attention to Brad and his hammers and nails. Brad's employers had a giant house with vast green fields, and they had 4 kids, all bigger than Nell, who would come out in fancy clothes and ride those horses. But Mom broke up with Brad. She didn't like craftsmen, she said, because they were too much like actual Victorians, always spouting all kinds of crap about how one thing was better than another thing, which eventually led, she explained, to the belief that some people were better than others. She took up with a guy named Bert, who eventually moved in with them. Bert explained to Nell and Harve that the house needed discipline, and that he intended to provide it, and after that he spanked them all the time, sometimes on the butt and sometimes on the face. He spanked Mom a lot, too. Nell was spending much more time at the playground, where it was easier for her to do all of the exercises that Dojo was teaching to Belle. She also played games with the other kids sometimes. One day she was playing tetherball with a friend of hers and kept beating her every time. Then a boy came up, a boy bigger than either Nell or her friend, and insisted that he be allowed to play. Nell's friend gave up her place, and then Nell played against the boy, whose name was Kevin. Kevin was a big, solid boy who was proud of his bulk and his strength, and his philosophy of tetherball was winning through intimidation. He would grab the ball, wind up melodramatically, baring his teeth and getting his face bright red, then smash the ball with a windmill punch, complete with sound effects that always showered the ball with spit. The performance was so impressive that many children just stood and watched it in awe, afraid to get in the way of the tetherball. And after that, Kevin would just keep smashing the ball faster and faster on each revolution while vomiting profanity at his opponent. Nell knew that Kevin's mom had lived with a lot of the same guys that Nell's mom had lived with. He frequently sported black eyes that he certainly hadn't gotten on the playground. Nell had always been afraid of Kevin. But today, when he wound up for his big serve, he just looked silly. Kind of like Dinosaur did sometimes when sparring with Belle. The ball swung toward her, dewy with spit, and not really going all that fast. Kevin was shouting things at her, calling her a cunt, in other words, but for some reason Nell didn't hear it and didn't care. She just lunged toward the ball and punched it hard, putting her whole body behind her knuckles in a straight line, just as Dojo taught. She hit the ball so hard she didn't even feel it. It shot up in a wide arc that took it behind and above Kevin's head, and after that, All she had to do was give it a few more slaps as it whizzed by, and she'd won the game.
2 out of 3,
Kevin said, and they played again, with the same result. Now all the kids were laughing at Kevin, and he lost his temper, turning bright red and charged at Nell. But Nell had watched Kevin use this tactic on other kids, and she knew that it only worked because usually the kids were too scared to move. Dojo had explained to Belle that the best way to fight Dinosaur was simply to get out of his way and let his own strength defeat him. So that's what Nell did with Kevin. Stepped aside at the last minute, made one foot into a hook, and tripped him. Kevin smashed tremendously into a swing set, gathered himself up, and charged a second time. Nell dodged him and tripped him again.
Okay, Kevin said. You win.
He approached Nell, holding out his right hand to shake, but Nell had seen this one too, and she knew it was a trick. She reached out with her right hand as if she were going to shake, but as Kevin was groping at this bait, every muscle in his arm tense, Nell turned her palm toward the floor and drew her hand down, then back across the middle of her body. She was watching Kevin as she did this, and saw that his eyes were tracking her hand, mesmerized. She continued to move her hand around in a long ellipse, turning her palm upward, thrusting it forward, poking her fingers into Kevin's staring eyes. He put his hands to his face. She kicked him between the legs as hard as she could, taking her time and striking the target precisely. As he bent over, she grabbed his hair and kneed him in the face, then shoved him down on his butt and left him there, too surprised for the moment to start bawling. Hackworth lunches in distinguished company. A disquisition on hypocrisy. Hackworth's situation develops new complications. Hackworth arrived at the pub first. He got a pint of porter at the bar, cask-conditioned stuff from the nearby Dovetail community, and strolled around the place for a few minutes while he waited. He had been fidgeting at his desk all morning and enjoyed the opportunity to stretch his legs. The place was done up like an ancient London publican house circa World War II, complete with fake bomb damage to one corner of the structure and taped X's over each window pane, which only made Hackworth think of Dr. X. Autographed photos of British and American airmen were stuck up on the walls here and there, along with other miscellany recalling the heyday of Anglo-American cooperation.
Send a gun to defend a British home. British civilians faced with threat of invasion desperately need arms for the defense of their homes. You can aid.
American Committee for Defense of British Homes.
Bowler hats hung in clusters from poles and wall hooks all over the room, like great bunches of black grapes. A lot of engineers and artifexes seemed to come to this place. They hunched over pints of beer at the bar and delved into steak and kidney pies at the little tables, chatting and chuckling. There was nothing prepossessing about the place or its patrons, but Hackworth knew that the odds and ends of nanotechnological lore collected in the heads of these middle-class artisans was what ultimately kept New Atlantis wealthy and secure. He had to ask himself why he hadn't been satisfied with simply being one of them. John Percival Hackworth projected his thoughts into matter and did it better than anyone else in this place. But he had felt the need to go beyond that. He had wanted to reach beyond mere matter and into someone's soul. Now, whether he wanted to or not, he was going to reach hundreds of thousands of souls. The men at the tables watched him curiously, then nodded politely and looked away when he caught their eye. Hackworth had noticed a full-lane Rolls-Royce parked in front of the place on his way in. Someone important was here, evidently in a back room. Hackworth and everyone else in the place knew it, and they were all in a heightened state of alertness, wondering what was up. Major Napier rode up on a standard-issue cavalry chevaline and came in at noon on the dot, pulling off his officer's hat and exchanging a hilarious greeting with the barkeep. Hackworth recognized him because he was a hero, and Napier recognized Hackworth for reasons left provocatively unspecified. Hackworth translated his pint to the left and exchanged a vigorous handshake with Major Napier in front of the bar. They strolled toward the back of the place, exchanging some hearty, forgettable, balderdash-laden banter. Napier stepped nimbly in front of him and pulled open a small door in the back wall. 3 steps led down into a little snuggery with mullioned windows on 3 sides and a single copper-covered table in the middle. A man was sitting by himself at the table, and as Hackworth descended the steps, he realized that it was Lord Alexander Chungsik
Finkel McGraw, who stood up, returned his bow, and greeted him with a warm and hearty handshake, taking such evident measures to put Hackworth at ease that, in some respects, the opposite result was achieved. More banter, a bit more restrained. A waiter came in. Hackworth ordered a steak sandwich, today's special, and Napier simply nodded to the waiter to indicate his complete agreement, which Hackworth took as a friendly gesture. Finkel McGraw declined to eat anything. Hackworth was not really hungry anymore. It was clear that Royal Joint Forces Command had figured out at least some of what had happened, and that Finkel McGraw knew about it too. They had decided to approach him privately instead of simply lowering the boom on him and drumming him out of the file. This should have filled him with boundless relief, but it didn't. Things had seemed so simple after his prosecution in the Celestial Kingdom. Now he suspected they were about to get infinitely more complicated.
"Mr. Hackworth," Finkel McGraw said, after the pleasantries had petered out, speaking in a new tone of voice,
the meeting will come to order sort of voice.
"Please favor me with your opinion of hypocrisy."
"Excuse me? Hypocrisy, Your Grace?"
"Yes, you know."
"It's a vice, I suppose?"
"A little one or a big one? Think carefully. Much hinges upon the answer."
"I suppose that depends upon the particular circumstances."
"That will never fail to be a safe answer, Mr. Hackworth," the equity lord said reproachfully.
Major Napier laughed somewhat artificially, not knowing what to make of this line of inquiry.
"Recent events in my life have renewed my appreciation for the virtues of doing things safely," Hackworth said. Both of the others chuckled knowingly.
"You know, when I was a young man, hypocrisy was deemed the worst of vices," Finkel McGraw said. "It was all because of moral relativism. You see, in that sort of a climate, you are not allowed to criticize others. After all, if there is no absolute right and wrong, then what grounds is there for criticism?"
Finkel McGraw paused, knowing that he had the full attention of his audience, and began to withdraw a calabash pipe and various related supplies and implements from his pockets. As he continued, he charged the calabash with a blend of leather-brown tobacco so redolent that it made Hackworth's mouth water. He was tempted to spoon some of it into his mouth.
"Now, this led to a good deal of general frustration, for people are naturally censorious and love nothing better than to criticize other shortcomings. And so it was that they seized on hypocrisy and elevated it from a ubiquitous peccadillo into the monarch of all vices. For you see, even if there is no right and wrong, you can find grounds to criticize another person by contrasting what he has espoused with what he has actually done. In this case, you're not making any judgment whatsoever as to the correctness of his views or the morality of his behavior. You are merely pointing out that he has said one thing and done another. Virtually all political discourse in the days of my youth was devoted to the ferreting out of hypocrisy. You wouldn't believe the things they said about the original Victorians. Calling someone a Victorian in those days was almost like calling them a fascist or a Nazi."
Both Hackworth and Major Napier were dumbfounded.
"Your Grace!" Napier exclaimed. "I was naturally aware that their moral stance was radically different from ours, but I am astonished to be informed that they actually condemned the first Victorians."
"Of course they did,"
Finkel McGraw said.
"Because the first Victorians were hypocrites," Hackworth said, getting it.
Finkel McGraw beamed upon Hackworth like a master upon his favorite pupil.
"As you can see, Major Napier, my estimate of Mr. Hackworth's mental acuity was not ill-founded."
"Well, I would never have supposed otherwise, Your Grace," Major Napier said. "It is nonetheless gratifying to have seen a demonstration."
Napier raised his glass in Hackworth's direction.
"Because they were hypocrites," Finkel McGraw said, after igniting his calabash and shooting a few tremendous fountains of smoke into the air. "The Victorians were despised in the late 20th century. Many of the persons who held such opinions were, of course, guilty of the most nefandous conduct themselves, and yet saw no paradox in holding such views because they were not hypocrites themselves. They took no moral stances and lived by none."
"So they were morally superior to the Victorians," Major Napier said, still a bit snowed under, "even though, in fact, because they had no morals at all."
There was a moment of silence, bewildered head-shaking around the copper table.
"We take a somewhat different view of hypocrisy," Finkel McGraw continued.
In the late 20th century Weltanschauung, a hypocrite was someone who espoused high moral views as part of a planned campaign of deception. He never held these beliefs sincerely and routinely violated them in privacy. Of course, most hypocrites are not like that. Most of the time, it's a spirit is willing, flesh is weak sort of thing.
That we occasionally violate our own stated moral code, Major Napier said, working it through, does not imply that we are insincere in espousing that code.
Of course not, Finkel McGraw said. It's perfectly obvious, really. No one ever said that it was easy to hew to a strict code of conduct. Really, the difficulties involved, the missteps we make along the way, are what make it interesting. The internal and eternal struggle between our base impulses and the rigorous demands of our own moral system is quintessentially human. It is how we conduct ourselves in that struggle that determines how we may in time be judged by a higher power.
All three men were quiet for a few moments, chewing mouthfuls of beer or smoke, pondering the matter.
I cannot help but infer, Hackworth finally said, that the present lesson in comparative ethics, which I thought was nicely articulated and for which I am grateful, must be thought to pertain in some way to my situation.
The other men raised their eyebrows in a not very convincing display of mild astonishment. The equity lord turned toward Major Napier, who took the floor briskly and cheerfully.
We do not know all the particulars of your situation. As you know, Atlantan subjects are entitled to polite treatment from all branches of HM's joint forces, unless they violate the tribal norms, and that means, in part, that we don't go around putting people under high-res surveillance just because we are curious about their avocations. In an era when everything can be surveilled, all we have left is politeness. However, we do, quite naturally, monitor comings and goings through the border. And not long ago, our curiosity was piqued by the arrival of one Lieutenant Chang of the District Magistrate's office. He was also clutching a plastic bag containing a rather battered top hat. Lieutenant Chang proceeded directly to your flat, spent half an hour there, and departed, minus the hat.
The steak sandwiches arrived at the beginning of this bit of exposition. Hackworth began messing about with condiments as if he could belittle the importance of this conversation by paying equal attention to having just the right goodies on his sandwich. He fussed with his pickle for a while, then began examining the bottles of obscure sauces arrayed in the center of the table, like a sommelier appraising a wine cellar.
"I'd been mugged in the Leith territories," Hackworth said absently, "and Lieutenant Chang recovered my hat somewhat later from a ruffian."
He had fixed his gaze, for no special reason, on a tall bottle with a paper label printed in an ancient crabbed typeface. McWhorter's Original Condiment was written large, and everything else was too small to read. The neck of the bottle was also festooned with black and white reproductions of ancient medals awarded by pre-Enlightenment European monarchs at exhibitions in places like Riga. Just a bit of violent shaking and thwacking ejected a few spurts of the ochre slurry from a pore-sized orifice at the top of the bottle, which was guarded by a quarter-inch encrustation. Most of it hit his plate, and some impacted on his sandwich.
"Yes," Major Napier said, reaching into his breast pocket and taking out a folded sheet of smart foolscap. He told it to uncrease itself on the table and prodded it with a nib of a silver fountain pen the size of an artillery shell. "Gatehouse records indicate that you do not venture into the LT often, Mr. Hackworth, which is certainly understandable and speaks well of your judgment. There have been two forays in recent months. On the first of these, you left in mid-afternoon and returned late at night, bleeding from lacerations that seem to have been recently incurred, according to the..." Major Napier could not repress a tiny smile. "Evocative description logged by the Border Patrol officer on duty that night. On the second occasion, you again left in the afternoon and returned late, this time with a single deep laceration across the buttocks. Not visible, of course, but picked up by surveillance." Hackworth took a bite of his sandwich, correctly anticipating that the meat would be gristly and that he would have plenty of time to think about his situation while his molars subdued it. He did have plenty of time, as it turned out. But as frequently happened to him in these situations, he could not bring his mind to bear on the subject at hand. All he could think about was the taste of the sauce. If the manifest of the ingredients on the bottle had been legible, it would have read something like this. "Water. Blackstrap molasses. Imported habanero peppers. Salt. Garlic. Ginger. Tomato puree. Axle grease. Real hickory smoke.
snuff, butts of clove cigarettes, Guinness stout fermentation dregs, uranium mill tailings, muffler cores, monosodium glutamate, nitrates, nitrites, nitrotes and nitrutes, neutrites, natrotes, powdered pork nose hairs, dynamite-activated charcoal, match heads, used pipe cleaners, tar, nicotine, single malt whiskey, smoked beef lymph nodes, autumn leaves, red fuming nitric acid, bituminous coal, fallout, printer's ink, laundry starch, drain cleaner, blue chrysotile asbestos, carrageenan, BHA, BHT, and natural flavorings. He could not help smiling at his own complete haplessness, both now and on the night in question.
I will concede that my recent trips to the leased territories have not left me disposed to make any more.
This comment produced just the right sort of clubby, knowing smiles from his interlocutors. Hackworth continued.
I saw no reason to report the mugging to Atlantan authorities.
There was no reason, Major Napier said. Shanghai police might have been interested, though.
Ah, well, I did not report it to them either, simply because of their reputation.
This bit of routine wog-bashing would have elicited naughty laughter from most. Hackworth was struck by the fact that neither Finkel McGraw nor Napier rose to the bait.
And yet, Napier said, Lieutenant Chang belied that reputation, did he not? When he went to the trouble of bringing your hat, now worthless, to you in person, when he was off duty, rather than simply mailing it, or for that matter, throwing it away.
Yes, Hackworth said. I suppose he did.
We found it rather singular. While we would not dream of inquiring into the particulars of your conversation with Lieutenant Chang, or of prying into your affairs in any other way, it did occur to some suspicious minds here, ones that have perhaps been exposed to the Oriental milieu for too long, that Lieutenant Chang's intentions might not be entirely honorable, and that he might bear watching. At the same time, for your own protection, we decided to keep a motherly eye on you during any later sojourns beyond the dogpot grid.
Napier did some more scrawling on his paper. Hackworth watched his pale blue eyes jumping back and forth as various records materialized on its surface.
You took one more trip to the leased territories, actually across the causeway, across Pudong, into the old city of Shanghai, Napier said, where our surveillance machinery either malfunctioned or was destroyed by countermeasures. You returned several hours later with the chunk taken out of your ass.
Napier suddenly slapped the paper down on his desk, looked up at Hackworth for the first time in quite a while, blinking his eyes a couple of times as he refocused and relaxed against the sadistically designed wooden back of his chair. Hardly the first time that one of HM's subjects has gone for a nocturnal prowl on the wild side and come back having suffered a beating, but normally the beatings are much less severe, and normally they are bought and paid for by the victim. My assessment of you, Mr. Hackworth, is that you are not interested in that particular vice.
Your assessment is correct, sir, Hackworth said a bit hotly.
This self-vindication left him in the position of having to provide some better explanation of the puckered cicatrice running across his buttocks. Actually, he didn't have to explain anything. This was an informal luncheon, not a police interrogation. But it would not do much for his already tattered mammalian credibility if he let it pass without comment. As if to emphasize this fact, both of the other men were now silent for some time.
Do you have any more recent intelligence about the man named Chang? Hackworth asked.
It is singular that you should ask. As it happens, the whilom lieutenant, his colleague, a woman named Pao, and their superior, a magistrate named Fang, all resigned on the same day about a month ago. They have resurfaced in the Middle Kingdom.
You must have been struck by the coincidence that a judge who is in the habit of caning people enters the service of the Middle Kingdom, and shortly thereafter, a new Atlantan engineer returns from a visit to said clave, bearing marks of having been caned.
Now that you mention it, it is quite striking, Major Napier said.
The equity lord said,
It might lead one to conclude that the engineer in question owed some debt to a powerful figure within that clave, and that the judicial system was being used as a sort of collection agency.
Napier was ready for his leg of the relay.
Such an engineer, if one existed, might be surprised to know that John Zaibatsu is intensely curious about the Shanghainese gentleman in question, an honest-to-God mandarin of the Celestial Kingdom, if he is who we think he is, and that we have been trying for some time, with little success, to obtain more information about his activities. So
If the Shanghainese gentleman were to request that our engineer partake in activities that we would normally consider unethical or even treasonous, we might take an uncharacteristically forgiving stance, provided, that is, that the engineer kept us well informed.
I see. Would that be something like being a double agent, then?
Hackworth said. Napier winced, as if he were being caned himself. It is a crashingly unsubtle phrase, but I can forgive your using it in this context.
Would John Zaibatsu then make some kind of formal commitment to this arrangement?
It is not done that way, Major Napier said.
I was afraid of that, Hackworth said.
Typically, such commitments are superfluous, as in most cases the party has very little choice in the matter.
Yes, Hackworth said. I see what you mean.
The commitment is a moral one. A question of honor, Finkel McGraw said. That such an engineer falls into trouble is evidence of mere hypocrisy on his part. We are inclined to overlook this sort of routine caducity. If he goes on to behave treasonously, then that, of course, is a different matter. But if he plays his role well and provides information of value to Her Majesty's joint forces, then he has rather deftly parlayed a small error into a grand act of heroism. You may be aware that it is not unusual for heroes to receive knighthoods, among other more tangible rewards.
For a few moments, Hackworth was too startled to speak. He had expected exile, and perhaps deserved it. Mere forgiveness was more than he could have hoped for, but Finkel McGraw was giving him the opportunity for something much greater. A chance to enter the lower ranks of the nobility. An equity stake in the tribal enterprise. There was only one answer he could make, and he blurted it out before he had time to lose his nerve.
I thank you for your forbearance, he said, and I accept your commission. Please consider me to be at Her Majesty's service from this moment forward.
Waiter, bring some champagne, please, Major Napier called. I believe we have something to celebrate.